You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of April 2020 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up, Monocle's affairs editor Chris Chermak has the latest as Donald Trump temporarily suspends all immigration to the United States. Plus, we'll be heading to Germany to examine how the country is tentatively easing its lockdown restrictions. Also ahead.
Hello, I'm Fiona Wilson, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief. I'll be bringing us up to date on the coronavirus situation in Japan and talking about whether the Olympics will really happen next year.
Thank you very much, Fiona. We'll also have the latest business news, and Monocle's Nolan Giles will be here for a roundup from the design world too. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. First, though, we begin in the United States, where President Donald Trump has announced that he will sign an executive order to temporarily suspend all immigration to the country. Let's get more on this now with Monocle's affairs editor Chris Chermak. Chris, welcome to the program. So President Trump sent a tweet about his plans last night. How much do we know now?
So to put it simply, we don't know much more than the tweet itself. So as you said, he announced that he would sign an executive order temporarily, it should be said, suspending immigration. But we don't really know much more than that. His tweet specified that this was to do with, of course, the coronavirus pandemic, the invisible enemy, as he called it in his tweet, but also protecting the jobs of Americans. And it was quite striking that this was clearly not something necessarily planned, because there was no further information from the White House. There was no further information from the Department of Homeland Security. What we do know is, for example, the New York Times is reporting that this will involve later this week barring green card holders or barring new green cards from being issued, as well as any work visas to the United States. So some details are coming out, but actually nothing official yet on what this means.
Well, is this yet another example of Trump blaming migration for the problems the US is facing? What do you think actually is Trump's motivation?
I think there's certainly has to be some truth to that, and particularly because of the timing of this, right? Because if we look at the current timing, or what is currently the situation, the US has effectively already closed its borders, as have many other countries, and this has been agreed with Mexico and Canada. The processing of visa and asylum applications has essentially been halted. So the question really does become, what is this meant to achieve? And the timing in that sense is quite curious, right? Because he could have announced this earlier in the struggle to confront the pandemic. But instead, he's announcing it at a point where he is keen to reopen the economy. So therefore, it certainly suggests that there's something of an ulterior motive here to perhaps, even though he says that this is temporary, to keep some kind of suspension on immigration going beyond the point where the economies of various states are actually being reopened.
Does Trump have the right to impose a full suspension of immigration, or could it be challenged in the courts?
So this is the kind of thing that one can imagine certainly will be challenged in the courts. But having said that, I think many people abroad, but also in the US, will have been surprised over the last few years to see just how much leeway the U.S. president has on this kind of issue on immigration, particularly if he can justify it on some sort of national security grounds, right? So we look at like one of the most prominent cases of the Trump administration, where he imposed a travel ban on Muslim-majority countries. He had announced that he would impose a ban on Muslims, but he was later able to modify this ban to focus on specific countries, adding a few non-Muslim-majority countries. And that was enough for the Supreme Court to say that they trust the law that he was, or the executive order that he was imposing, rather than the words that he had given on religion. And so what we found in that case, for example, is that actually the U.S. president has the right to suspend nationals from different countries entering the United States if there is a national security grounds. So the key thing here will be in the details. It will depend on the justification that he gives for this executive order. the length of time that he's going to impose this for, but he does have a good amount of leeway for certainly a temporary suspension of this kind.
Mm. What kind of a response do you expect? Do you think the US public, for example, will support Trump's plan?
Well, I mean, if you clearly this was, I shouldn't say clearly, but one can imagine that this was timed in some degree with the November elections in mind and plays into Trump's political motivations. And in that sense, the country is, of course, incredibly divided. But Trump himself has been, of course, very clear that cutting immigration is a priority. And this has played very well with his base, right, with his more Republican base, those that are skeptical of immigration. And you can certainly see him laying the groundwork here, if you will, for a sort of campaign pledge to focus on American workers at a time of immense economic struggle and painting Democrats as favoring immigrants at their expense as this continues and the economy tries to get back on a rebound. So there is a very powerful and albeit dangerous argument here that could very well divide the country a lot more than it already is. If Trump wants to go down this route of making immigrants the scapegoat, essentially, of this crisis.
And just finally, Chris, before I let you go, do you think, is it too early to estimate if the way Trump is trying to handle this coronavirus outbreak, is that having an impact on his popularity now before the November election?
That's a good question. You know, it's been somewhat mixed, to be honest. I mean, the U.S. In general tends to be a country, as with many others, but that you rally around the president in a time of crisis. And so early on, even as this pandemic was gathering steam and there was a lot of criticism of Donald Trump's handling of it, we actually saw his approval ratings going up. But having said that, the question now, or having said that, now it might be changing a little bit because particularly most Americans very much are in favor of keeping the lockdown in place. If anything, most Americans are actually worried that the lockdowns could end too soon, that the economy could be given too much priority. And so that could start to play in a disfavor, if you will, for Donald Trump if the public clearly starts to feel that he does not have this crisis under control and that he has other issues, other priorities in mind, if you will. So it'll be very interesting to see, and it's a bit too early, I'd say, to tell exactly what kind of impact this will have on his November election chances.
Chris Chermak, Monocle's affairs editor there, thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. We are heading to Germany now to examine how the country is beginning to ease lockdown restrictions. I'm joined on the line by Anna Rosenberg, who is head of Europe and the UK at political consultancy Signum Global. Anna joins me on the line from the Black Forest in southwestern Germany. Welcome to the program. So, Anna, some small shops have been allowed to reopen already, and schools are expected to begin reopening in the beginning of next month. What is the mood in Germany? Are people excited about the easing of some of the restrictions, or is there much worry about the easing possibly coming a bit too early?
I think there is a mix of that probably at present. Of course, there is some excitement about being in the control, the pandemic being under control to some extent. But at the same time, there's, of course, also the worry that this is in a way premature and that we could see soon a second spike in infections. So I think it's mixed. People are keen to resume their freedoms again, but at the same time, they're also wary.
How much debate has there been over what the right first steps are when it comes to easing restrictions?
There has been a lot of debate, obviously. I think one of the strengths that Germany has, especially compared to many other European countries, is the federal system. And so you have a lot of power ability in the different states across Germany. And that means that each state really can take its own decisions when it comes to opening certain aspects of the economy, certain shops, resuming schools, etc. And that means that there has been a lot of debate between the different states and, of course, also on the state level. But ultimately, the decisions that are being taken reflect the local dynamics in each state. And that's a good thing because it can really adjust to the realities of the infections.
So smaller shops have been allowed to reopen now. And as I mentioned already, schools are expected to reopen in the beginning of next month. What are the other next steps?
Sure. So some schools are allowed to reopen, and this is very different in different members, in different states. So, for example, in some states, there's a prioritization for the classes that are close to taking their final exams, versus in others, they have decided to let younger students return to the schools. In some states, you also have different requirements when it comes to wearing face masks. That is not a national requirement. Merkel has made this a recommendation, but it has been already embraced by more and more states. So, for example, Bavaria, which has been in favor of very strict lockdown measures, has embraced it already. Now, Baden-Württemberg has followed suit, as well as Thuringia. So there are more states that are embracing that. Overall, the regulations are similar. Shops up to 800 square meters are allowed to reopen again. That does not apply for bookstores as well as car and bicycle stores. Those are allowed to open irrespective of their size. And other than that, also hairdressers are allowed to reopen from the beginning of May. But again, the regulations vary widely by state.
Now, how big of an issue has it been when it comes to, say, Angela Merkel's decision making that, as you say, the states also do have a lot of power and they want to possibly go their own directions?
Well, it's been obviously a huge political tool as well, because one thing that the COVID crisis has done in Germany is it has calmed the political tension that was existent in the governing coalition. You may remember just a few weeks ago, there was a lot of talk about early elections in Germany with AKK resigning her succession, really, of the chancellorship. And now that has completely died down. Merkel has seen a huge surge in approval ratings. And what you're seeing now is that the individual presidents, the ministerpräsident of each state, are vying for her succession in a way. And you see that specifically between Markus Söder in Bavaria and Armin Laschet in Nordrhein-Westfalen. They are both trying to position themselves on the opposite spectrum of the lockdown debate in order to win political favor.
Now, many countries obviously are carefully following Germany's example, and it looks like Germany has been able to deal with this outbreak relatively well compared to many other nations. First of all, why do you think that is? And secondly, do you think other countries can learn something from Germany?
So it's a combination of luck, good preconditions, and then also just a good reaction, if you will. So luck mainly because the average age of the infected person in Germany is usually quite younger than other countries. So for example, I think in Germany it's 49 years, versus in Italy and France it was more like 62 and 69. So the age difference has been quite different, and that already has, of course, an effect onto the death numbers. Secondly, the people who brought the disease into Germany were mostly coming from skiing holidays in Italy. And so overall, we're quite fit and healthy. So that's when it comes to the luck portion of it. The other important element is the predisposition. Germany's healthcare system is incredibly luxurious in a way. It has a very well-developed network of laboratories where all GPs do a lot of testing at the laboratory level. And early on in the disease, the Charité shared the recipe, if you will, for how to conduct testing with all these laboratories. So it was very quickly able, Germany, to do wide-scale testing in all its laboratories. And finally, Germany has also been quite efficient when it comes to tracing. And I think a combination of these things has helped Germany to stay on top of that. Other countries can learn from that to some extent, but not all countries have the same infrastructure in place when it comes to, for example, the laboratories, nor the number of intensive care unit beds per inhabitants. So in a way, there's only some things that other countries can emulate.
And just finally, is it too early to estimate how badly this outbreak has actually hit the German economy? And how much optimism is there about a speedy recovery?
I think that's far too early in a way, and I do think that the optimism that we're seeing right now is not warranted, and not just in Germany, on a global level, on a European-wide level. It's very likely we're going to see second waves of infections. We're going to probably see new lockdowns. This will only end the pandemic will only end, the economic impact will only end once we have a medical solution to it. And with that, I mean either treatment or vaccine. I think there's a lot of false hope emerging right now because of talk about easing of lockdown measures. We're not out of the woods yet. We're now entering a new normal with very severe reduced economic activity, reduced consumption activity, ongoing social distancing. And that one will be in place for quite a while. It's going to hit the economy. It's going to hit the way we used to live. And until we get to the end of this, it's still going to take some time. And the economic hit will be much more significant than we currently assume.
Sobering thoughts there from Anna Rosenberg. Thank you very much for joining us. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You are listening to The Briefing and we continue from Germany to Japan. Now, I'm joined on the line from Tokyo by Monocle's senior editor, Fiona Wilson. Fiona, welcome back to the program. So, last week, Japan declared a state of emergency because of the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. What's the latest on coronavirus cases in the country?
Well, Marcus, we had Shinzo Abe, the Prime Minister, speaking to reporters today and really making a further request to the public to stay at home. He wants to get contact down by 80% and he's asking people not to go out from the cities to the countryside. I think the big concern is that we've got what we call Golden Week in Japan coming up. It's a run of holidays and it's usually a time when people travel all over the country. And Shinzo Abe is very keen to make sure that people try and stay where they are. They don't move between prefectures, potentially taking the virus with him. Numbers have been going up. They're not the kind of numbers you're seeing in Europe or the US by any means, but they've certainly increased quite rapidly over the last couple of weeks. And Tokyo's the hotspot really. So that's where Governor Koike, Governor of Tokyo, she's also been putting out requests for people to try and minimize their outings. Don't go out shopping with your family in groups. Don't go into close contact with people. Please, don't go into crowded environments. So just reinforcing that message. We've been talking about this for ages. The message has been a little bit weak, but they're trying to ramp it up, I think, because the holidays will come at the end of this month and run until the end of the first week in May. So it's really important to get the message out now.
Absolutely. And now there is also doubt about whether the Olympic Games, which have already been postponed, will be able to take place next year. Tell us more.
Well, that's right. I mean, as you know, it's been postponed till next summer, but there's now even a question mark over next summer. And we've had Kentaro Iwata, he's a professor of infectious diseases at Kobe University. He's been speaking quite a lot recently. And he said, look, let's get real here. Even if Japan has solved its virus problem by next summer, what about other places in the world? This is an international event, people coming from everywhere. It might not be clear by next summer. And, there's at the same time as this, there's a big debate raging about who is going to pay for the postponement, which is already running into billions of dollars. The IOC is very keen that Japan shoulders the bill and Japan is not quite so enthusiastic. So there's a separate argument going on there. But I think in terms of the virus, there's obviously a question mark about whether it will even be happening next summer at this point.
There is also a rather tangible example of how the coronavirus outbreak is hitting Japanese businesses. Nissan is to shut down its global HQ temporarily.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, not a huge surprise. All the car makers in Japan have really cut down production. Global demand is obviously slumped. So you've got Toyota, Honda, Nissan all shutting down factories, plants within Japan, and their overseas plants have also been shuttered. So, but Nissan today said they're closing, really shutting down the global HQ in Yokohama. So there'll be about 15,000 people who won't be going to work. They're shutting down the R&D facility, which is near Yokohama as well in Kanagawa. And, really, production is going to be at a minimum. People are just not out buying cars at the moment. So I think it's really facing the reality of what's going on.
And just one more news story from Japan. Major carriers there say they will use their passenger planes to transport medical supplies from overseas.
That's right. Well, Japan, like everywhere else, is suffering from a shortage of personal protective equipment. And JAL, Japan Airlines, and ANA, All Nippon Airways, have both said, they can step in. They've lost 90% of their international flights passengers have just dropped off. So they're saying we can bring the equipment from places that where it is being manufactured, so probably China, Southeast Asia, and they'll bring it in. And they're going to be carrying it not only in the hold, but also in the cabin. So they're using overhead lockers. They'll be tying stuff to the seats. And they reckon that can really increase the tonnage. So that's already started. JAL said they've started yesterday, and ANA said they'll be starting that this week. So more equipment should be coming into Japan.
Hopefully. Thank you very much. That was Monocle's Fiona Wilson in Tokyo. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Let's next get to the latest business news. I'm joined by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. A warm welcome back to The Briefing, Ewan. So, historic news today. The US oil price has been trading below zero today as coronavirus continues to hit demand. Could you explain how this has come about?
Hello, Marcus. Yes, the meltdown in oil markets is widening today. Yesterday started like any other gloomy Monday in the oil markets, worst crisis in a generation. It ended with prices falling below history, falling below zero for the first time in history. At one point late yesterday evening, European time, traders were willing to pay $40 a barrel just to get somebody to take crude oil off their hands. Now, this is the first time this has happened. There is partly a technical reason for this in that the oil price we quote is a futures contract, is a monthly futures contract. And when that contract expires, there are often some strange movements, but they've never dropped below zero before. Today is the final day of trading for the May contract. And of course, May is perhaps likely to be the worst month for oil demand as the global economy continues in lockdown. But we're also seeing some of these concerns roll over into the June contract, which is trading at the moment. And that is also down very sharply today as investors bet that the oil market is not going to be fixed by June. We saw that drop as much as 40% briefly earlier. And US oil for delivery in June is now trading at just $16 a barrel.
Could you tell us a bit more about the wider economic implications of all this?
Yeah, well, I guess let's start off with a bit of good news. Of course, cheap oil is good for consumers across the world, in as far as any of us are using any oil at the moment, which is probably not very much. It's good news for importers, countries which import and net importers of oil. That's most of Europe and many countries around the world, including, of course, China, the world's biggest importer. But it does add a deflationary risk for central banks. Central banks have been battling worries about deflation for the last 10 years. And of course, with the massive demand shock from coronavirus and as the world enters a steep recession, there are again worries that we could see disinflation and perhaps deflation. And a lower oil price is not helpful for that. It's pretty bad news for the US shale industry, which is a big provider of jobs, a lot of capital tied up in the American shale industry. At the moment, we reckon that the US is now producing about 2 million barrels a day more than it can consume. The US is now the world's biggest oil producer. And of course, this means severely dented budgets in producer countries from Saudi Arabia to Russia and Canada. And particularly, this will be hard felt in emerging economies like Nigeria, which are very, very dependent on oil to balance their budgets.
Thank you very much for that update. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts joining us here on The Briefing.
Have you heard the late edition on Monocle 24? Now more than ever, the time is right for a global conversation that cuts through the white noise and brings clarity, genuine insight, and just the right tone to news and analysis. If you're tired of strident anchors and the wearying pace of the news ticker, then join Monocle's editors every weekday for the late edition, a lively, friendly, and forward-looking kick-around of the day's main stories. Hosted each evening by our editors from Zurich, London, Toronto and New York City, the late edition premieres at 2200 CET, 2100 in London, 1600 in NYC and 1300 in Los Angeles. And if you miss it, you can hear it again 3 hours later. The late edition weekdays at 1600 Eastern Time on Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24, and finally on today's programme we're going to get a design roundup with Monocle's own Nolan Giles. Thanks for joining us, Nolan. So, the world's largest design and furniture fair, Salone del Mobile, was meant to kick off today, and you, Nolan, definitely weren't supposed to be in London. You were meant to be in Milan as well. This obviously didn't happen because of the coronavirus outbreak. Now, companies had been preparing for the fair for months and months. What do you think? How will all that work be showcased, or will it?
Yeah, sadly, Marcus, I'm at home in London in my bedroom rather than sipping an Aperol Spritz in Milan. But yeah, it's a huge loss for the industry. It's actually quite amazing when this doesn't happen, just how much, I guess, furniture, supply chains, everything around the world grinds to a halt. This is the big marketing and sales event for the entire industry. It's not even like fashion where, you know, you have different different shows across different cities across the year. Essentially, you know, a lot of orders for furniture, whether that's a new hotel in Beijing or, you know, a property in London, a lot of it is done here. So essentially, this hasn't happened. New releases that were scheduled to happen today and this week obviously haven't gone ahead. Some things have been released digitally, but I mean, the whole thing with furniture and design is it's really a medium that you have to experience firsthand to really appreciate and spend money on.
So, looking at the situation, obviously, we're talking about exceptional circumstances. How much have we been hearing, for example, from the organizers of Salone in regards to postponing the event all the way until next year?
I mean, they've obviously had to be super positive. Firstly, because it's in Italy, and Italy is, you know, the most important furniture manufacturing country in the world. So not only are they, not only do they have the task of supporting their own event, they really have the whole industry on their back. And I think it's been an interesting time for this because for the first time we've seen these huge companies, all separately owned in Italy, all coming together under one umbrella to really kind of fight for that name of Italian design and quality and, you know, get back to work and really highlight the fact that when things do hopefully go back to normality and Salone del Mobile happens next year, it's going to be bigger and better and a stronger offering than ever before.
Well, Nolan, despite Salone not taking place this year, you have still come across some great innovative design. Tell us more.
Yeah, so in terms of new designs, obviously there's not much really that people need when they're confined to their homes, but a bicycle is definitely a handy one to have. And Van Moof, who are a Dutch bike company, they used to do electronic bikes and normal bikes, have shifted their focus entirely on to the e-bike. And they, in a few minutes, actually, around 2 p.m. European time, they're going to be launching the S3 and X3, which look to be super beautiful, smartly designed bikes that are actually affordable, and it will really kind of change the market, I think, for electronic bikes, maybe globally.
What are the aspects that impress you most about that design?
Well, in terms of the design, Vamoose become known for, you know, minimalist, sharp kind of lines, really creative but not over the top bike designs. They're typically in black and white, so it's not ostentatious or anything like that. But in Dutch style, you know, they're super sturdy and they work when you need them to work. And the most appealing thing about this these models in particular, it looks like their pricing is going to be reduced significantly. So before you were looking at around £3,200 to get on one of their e-bikes, now you're going to be looking at around £1,800, which when you're thinking about a vehicle that can replace a car or a scooter in a lot of circumstances, it's actually not a lot of money.
So Nolan, once this outbreak is over and you're going to start heading to work again, are you going to be cycling with that kind of a bike by any chance? Are you going to go online and make your purchase already?
Well, Marcus, it's about a 7-mile ride to work from my house, and for now I can handle it on a standard bike. I don't need that kind of electronic power to get me to work. But, you know, when the deadlines start piling up and things get a bit more stressful, who knows, maybe like an electronic bike will make me come to work feeling a bit more refreshed and energized.
Maybe. Monocle's design editor, Nolan Giles, there. Thank you very much. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Yolin Goffin. It was researched by Charlie Filmacourt, and our studio manager was Sam Impey. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That is at midday London time, 7 a.m. if you're listening in Washington, D.C. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.